Good afternoon. I was always told when I was in my 20s and I used to put on shows sometimes, they always said, get a small venue and then it'll look like you have a popular session. So sorry for the seating. Obviously, there isn't a lot of interest in the issue of the environment, Doug, so. Oh, well. I wanted to put this session together because to really mark the accomplishment of the CNU group that's brought about LEAD-ND, and maybe to start to set a policy about moving forward. So I actually have taken the time to try to write down some thoughts. So forgive me for actually doing that instead of just winging it. The CNU charter describes disinvestment in central cities, the spread of placeless sprawl, increasing separation by race and income, environmental deterioration, loss of agricultural lands and wilderness, and the erosion of society's built heritage as one interrelated community building challenge. And indeed, the defining feature of the CNU is to see things as an interrelated set of issues and to see things in a holistic manner. Our great successes have really come in two areas, and I think both are essential. First of all, we have evolved a great body of design practice, all of which is transforming the way the built environment is produced. The new urbanists have introduced the charrette as a means of tackling complex design problems and engaging citizenry, revitalized regional planning, helped to stimulate a boom in new public transport systems and transit-oriented development, reintroduced form-based codes, and developed the transect as an urban analysis tool. We've evolved builders' pattern books to become urban pattern books, and we've stimulated a new understanding of local identity and regional character. Our second area of success has been in challenging standards and replacing specialized serial planning with standards that reflect the complexity of urbanism. The new LEAD-ND is a vital step toward a standard for greener urbanism. The proposal will teach environmentalists and green builders alike that location matters and that a green building in an auto-dependent suburb is not a green building. But it is just the start, and we should remember that it is a floor and not a ceiling. Where a fractious movement and the holistic approach envisioned by the Charter lurches forward, with factions of the movement always reminding us that we are failing the affordability test, or the organic places test, or the architecture test, or the green test. But the way to move us forward is through design evolution, and that's our core strength. Standards reflect the state of the practice and not where this practice needs to be. That's why I want to look beyond LEAD-ND, as we've just barely begun to evolve our design techniques to reflect sustainable environmental practice. And environmental practice is still largely anti-urban in philosophy and technique. So I want to propose three arguments and ask Doug to respond to them in a challenging and hopefully positive way. First, we need to understand that new urbanism is key to bringing about greener living. This is particularly true with respect to greenhouse gas emissions. Second, merely asserting that good urbanism is better than sprawl is simply not good enough. Third, addressing the challenges ahead is not a matter of checklists or goal setting or even standards alone. It is a matter of design, and we have a hell of a lot of work ahead before we as a movement can lay a claim to green urbanism. So let's first take up the question of urbanism and what Scott Bernstein, John Holtzclaw, David Goldberg, and I have been calling location efficiency for a number of years. In the mid-90s, we began working together to try to prove something that we knew from history and observation to be true, that people drove less and walked, bike, and rode transit more in cities that were designed to make those activities possible. Well, that may seem like a no-brainer, but the prevailing consensus among travel behavior specialists and transport and land use experts has been that this is nonsense. The people love their cars, and the more money they make, the more cars they buy, and the more of their money they spend sprawling and driving around. All of this is related to a pernicious notion among social scientists that place is irrelevant, and that environment is not determinative of behavior, to which our response has always been, design isn't everything, but it's something. A modest response, but usually rejected in social science. So we used smog check odometer readings to examine travel behavior for all the households in the 9-county San Francisco Bay Area, the 7-county Southern California metropolitan area, and the metropolitan area of Chicago. I forgot how many counties Chicago has. 6-county Chicago area. Literally millions of households across the urban transect from center to edge. We controlled for household income and size and looked at a series of urban design variables, including net residential density, street connectivity, and access to public transport, measured both by how close it is and how often it runs. We found a significant correlation between these three factors and use of the automobile. This chart shows it with respect to vehicle miles traveled per household and with respect to household residential density. You can see the three areas are plotted together. The curves are plotted, and you can see an identical curve fit, which gives us some confidence in being able to predict that decline. You can also see that most of the benefit occurs when you move from low auto densities of 4 to 5 units to acre or half-acre lots up to the densities that support bus and rail transit, 7 to 12 units to the acre for local bus service, 25 to 60 units to the acre for rail transit. These are not high-rise densities. They can be accommodated with row houses, courtyard apartment buildings, and mid-rise stacked flats. Up to about 75 units to the acre, each doubling of density roughly halves vehicle use and hence carbon emissions. The peer-reviewed study published in Transportation Planning and Technology also found that public transport and block connectivity were significant factors. As you can see in this nifty and impenetrable chart from the San Francisco Bay Area. Reductions in household travel are linked to central notions of the new urbanism: density, connected walkable streets, access to public transport, and by implication, the access to amenities, services, and jobs that could be sustained by these kinds of places. This means a fundamental rethinking by environmentalists about cities. Traditionally, being green has been about embracing wilderness, about opposing development. Cities were seen historically as soul-destroying, noisy, smelly, and dirty places. Closer look reveals that cities and towns are more environmentally friendly than sprawling suburbs. These charts, prepared by colleagues at the Center for Neighborhood Technology, make the point quite clearly. The chart on the left shows greenhouse gas emissions on an area basis for the San Francisco Bay Area, looking at a per square mile basis, making cities look far dirtier than suburbs and farmland. But when what you recalculate on a per household or a per capita basis, a different story emerges. City centers contribute much less carbon to the atmosphere than do suburban areas. And this is really just related to vehicle travel. The second chart shows the same impacts for the Chicago metropolitan area, as you can see. So blue is cool, red is hot, red is a lot of emissions, blue is not very many. Far from being the problem, cities are the answer, and urban design is at the core of the solution. My second proposition, I think this is something we really have to accept and probably have all accepted by faith. My second proposition is that asserting that new urbanism is better for the environment than sprawl, or even proving it, as I think I've just done, is no longer good enough. It is time to stop complaining about the environmentalists and get busy, for the problems are profound. Ed Masria, who will speak tomorrow, is fond of saying that buildings are the second largest contributor of greenhouse gas emissions. He achieved this result because he lumps together the residential and commercial sectors of the economy and assigns them to a new building sector, as you can see in this attached chart. When you look at the base data, a slightly different picture emerges. Transport is the second largest sector. Whatever our different take on the numbers, though, Masria and I are both reframing climate change from something that's largely about industrial sectors and about economics to something that is about the built environment. And we are both demonstrating, I think, that the built environment, urban form, personal transport, and buildings is at the heart of our greenhouse gas emissions problem. As I'm speaking in the United States, I suppose I have to say that climate change is a problem, that we've already made irreversible changes in the Earth's climate system through human activity, that we have very little time to begin to arrest further changes. Last month, I spent a day and a half in a climate training program for UK leaders taught by Al Gore. The chief criticism leveled by the scientific community present was that Vice President Gore, former Vice President Gore, did not sufficiently stress the degree to which climate impacts in the future had already been triggered by human action in the recent past. And they suggested that he needed to be spending more time on adaptation rather than on prevention. And we are in the UK because we are really dealing with sea level rise in places like London, which has a few people in it. His comment was that he didn't want people to move from denial to despair without stopping to actually try to do something about the problem. In Britain, we got a wake-up call last autumn from Sir Nicholas Stern, who undertook a review of climate issues from an economic point of view. Stern, who was the World Bank's former chief economist, undertook to examine a range of policies and model their costs, finding that it would cost about 1% of GDP to address climate change. And a recent IPCC, International Panel on Climate Change, put the cost at 1 to 2% GDP using different assumptions. Stern found that the potential economic impacts were on the scale of the two world wars of the 20th century and the Great Depression of the 20s and 30s. He said, tackling climate change is the pro-growth strategy for the longer term, and it can be done in a way that does not cap the aspirations of growth for rich or poor countries. And he further said, it's not just a matter of getting the trading scheme right, it's a matter of having a supportive set of policies that can make it possible for people to change their behavior, and that those were largely oriented around transport and land use and buildings. It's easy to blame environmental activists for silly stormwater requirements, but where I live now, flood risk assessments paint a chilling picture of the potential impact of life in a wetter Britain. And I live in Hampstead, which is well above the floodwaters, but it'll be wet where I go to work, and so one begins to worry about these things. Just doing better than sprawl is no longer good enough. At the same time, we must not merely solve to the lead and D test and miss the other tests of affordability, accessibility, housing, and employment diversity and the like. This must become a major emphasis of our work, yet we must continue to sell new urbanism as a quality of life enhancement. As John Norquist says, the convenient remedy for the inconvenient truth. My third proposition for the CMU to consider is that it is also not enough to set or adopt standards like LEED and D, or possibly tokenistic goals like Architecture 2030, or even to apply checklists like this one from the southeast of England, the sustainability checklist. All these might be worthy actions, but if we take them and think that we've done our job, we will be very wrong. We may have done more harm than good. I don't mean to suggest that we shouldn't have engaged with NRDC and the USGBC in the LEED for Neighborhood Development exercise. I agree that LEED and D might be the biggest step forward we have taken as a movement in years. The challenge now that we are in the LEED and D pilot phase is that we really don't have design solutions that are urban for a lot of the environmental challenges we face, and that where individual practitioners may have them, we as a movement do not have an ongoing shared design conversation about these solutions. And where design solutions do exist, there are often reductionist, single-order engineering solutions that undermine the very location efficiency, vitality, and walkability that makes urbanism environmentally effective in the first place. So if we don't want to be convicted by the law of unintended consequences, we must begin to develop urbanist solutions and share best practice through the Congress, through design-focused charter councils and our chapter meetings. I understand that Doug has just turned his sustainable urbanism book to the publisher, and so we can first buy it. He didn't actually ask me to do the plug, but I hope that can be the start of a spate of best practice sharing of technique rather than simply policy or application of standards. Designing in an ecological matter can no longer be treated as a question of gizmos and gadgets for the building or as a question of assessment or review afterwards. It is time to evolve and share new urban practice to confront new challenges. I believe that there are a number of distinct problems for which design intelligence, rather than policy intelligence, needs to be brought to bear. First is the question of scale. This applies to many environmental issues, including sustainable drainage, renewable energy applications, including wind and combined heat and power, and the distribution of other infrastructure. The UK, for example, currently provides grants for renewable energy installations for everything from solar hot water to fuel cell, wood chip stoves, and individual wind turbines. Tory leader David Cameron recently installed a wind turbine on his house in West London, with a payback period estimated by the Daily Mail of 40 years. His neighbors opposed planning permission, but it was ultimately granted for an installation on the chimney. When the builders installed it on this 120-year-old house, they had to attach it to the wall as they feared the lateral force on the chimney would pull it down along with the back side of the house. This violated the planning permission and the turbine had to be removed. When the foundation in the Duchy of Cornwall examined wind turbines in urban settings late last year, we learned that turbulence made them ineffective. There is some debate as to whether this is simply a short-term problem, and the cost-effectiveness may change, but it does call into question the government subsidy. At the next scale, all new developments in England will be required to generate at least 10% of power on-site through renewable energy sources by 2010. The London boroughs of Merton and Woking already require at least 10% renewables for each new development. Some are also exploring the next scale up, which is the provision of wind at the municipal level. At the same time, there is an explosion of interest in wind farms, with much of the north of Scotland being proposed for wind farm location, hundreds of kilometers away from the end users. These industrial wind farms are seen as a major new revenue source for rural landowners, but are bitterly opposed for at least three reasons: visual impact and noise, environmental impacts from power transmission, and the inefficiency of generating power so far from where it is used. This question of scale is also a question of design and visual impact, as I have tried to show in this primitive homage to Leon Krier. What is going to be the cumulative impact of wind energy generated on site for every English development? Might we be better doing it at the municipal scale? And is the individual house turbine going to become the chimney or television aerial of the contemporary era? If so, we'd better not leave the design solely to the engineer. This question of scale applies to all of the renewable energy technologies. It is a design question, it is a cost-effectiveness question, and it is a policy question. And with limited resources to deal with these problems, we ought to begin to develop an understanding among one another about where it makes sense to apply combined heat and power, wind, or rainwater harvesting, or a dozen other environmental techniques. The second challenge for urbanists is to relate environmental solutions to their urban context. This goes right back to the anti-urban bias that so often has existed in both the environmental profession, which really began to save wilderness, and the engineering professions. If we accept that cities are at the heart of the solution to the environmental problem, then we must design environmental techniques that respond appropriately to setting and place in the transect. Just as the street section must respond to context, so should the wind turbine, the permeable pavement, the drainage swale, and solar orientation. Let's take sustainable urban drainage for an example. The chart on the left depicts the sustainable drainage paradigm from a website of the Environment Agency in the UK, and two applications of it in the context of an arterial road and an English housing estate. Both are resolutely anti-urban and can really only be applied to conventional suburban development or the roads in the countryside. What's needed is for the urbanists to engage the engineers and hydrologists to define the parameters for sustainable drainage across the transect. At this point, as you can see, beyond T3, the smart code undergrounds it. I think we can do better than that, but it will require meeting the engineers part way. The foundation has been involved for a number of years at a sustainable urban extension to the town of Northampton called Upton. There we have been working with English Partnerships, the National Regeneration Agency, to evolve a master plan through a charrette and build it out pursuant to a design code developed with EDOF. The site is subject to flooding, and the project addresses sustainable drainage quite directly. It is organized around a system of sustainable urban drainage integrated into the street network, and you can see that system in the diagram on the left. Ponds are integrated into an adjacent county park, and three different street sections with swales were developed. And this is one of those sections, which I'll show in somewhat more detail. One street section places a street to one side of the sud system, and as you see, creates quite a large space, requiring some fairly imposing houses to create a sense of enclosure for the space. And you can judge for yourself whether we did that or we didn't properly, but it's a challenge. It's part of a street hierarchy, though, that includes lanes and mew streets, which do not have the sud solutions. This because they're covered in these large swales. This approach may be just fine in a T3 context, but ideally we should develop a set of street sections and drainage treatments that fill in the range between the wide swale and the permeable underground drain. We ought to think through materials and plantings that respond to the transect as well. This is an example of the need to begin to evolve environmental responses that work across the transect, but at the same time to advance our understanding of urbanism and evolve our precedents so that they have improved ecological performance. It must be a conversation, not a shouting match. And at this point, we have to stop raging about it from one side or the other and get busy. And I think a lot of us in our individual practices are doing that. But I think we have been so focused on lead indeed that we haven't done that as a group. The third issue is one that has both a design dimension and a PR dimension. When I was in school, ecological architecture was about studying Taos Pueblo and understanding how to build softly with little impact on the land. And I learned to work with adobe and straw bale. While this eco-vernacular hobbity approach to green still exists, at some point in the last 20 years, I started wearing ties. And somewhere in there, green has become a very high-tech thing. And it has gotten itself associated with steel and glass. Perhaps it began with this project, Bill Dunster's BedZ, which had high aspirations and still provides useful information about materials and systems. But from an urban standpoint, it's quite challenging. And from a design standpoint, it's a social housing estate, and people go there largely because the housing association assigns them to live there. BedZ was quickly followed by Norman Foster's Swiss Rebuilding, fondly dubbed by Londoners the Gherkin, which was called the greenest tall building, but has never released in energy performance figures and is roundly slated by the head of the building research establishment. And now Foster and partners are proposing a new eco-city in Abu Dhabi, which, as you see, has a sort of Blade Runner quality. I like Blade Runner. It's a good movie. That's where it should stay. I don't want to live there. Another eco-city has been proposed by Peter Head at AREP for Dong Tan, working with a colleague at the foundation who's been involved with the foundation, Herbie Girardet. It's an island of silt accumulation at the mouth of Shanghai's harbor. High-tech green has become the new export for UK PLC. And I expect this will become increasingly true for architects, major architectural firms around the world. Each announcement follows the same pattern. Some low-res, evocative images are produced and distributed. Green promises are made, and the project moves forward without a lot of scrutiny. And as you can see with Dong Tan, it is, in fact, an island of silt accumulation at the mouth of Shanghai Harbor. It appears to be a street grid centered around a set of sort of islands in the park kind of buildings. And whether it's actually the image for sustainability, I'm not sure. There is another option to create an ecological urbanism that responds to place, in material, in building culture, and in heritage, but also by being transparent about our performance objectives and by submitting to measurement afterwards. The use of local adaptation as a base is important. If ecological building to move from being a design statement about technology to being a serious response to current systems of production of houses, flats, and commercial buildings. We don't have all the answers to the challenge of creating sustainable communities, or of adapting traditional urbanism to a world of peak oil, global climate change, and sea level rise. But we know that tradition must evolve to respond to changed conditions. This evolution presents a challenge to us all. I've shown some images of suds at Upton in Northamptonshire, and I would just note that this project was really begun by Chip Kaufman and Wendy Morris, leading the charrette, and Wendy is here. And the early phases feature sustainable urban drainage systems, natural materials, and sheep's wool insulation. In later phases incorporate more cutting-edge ecological approaches. All of the parts of the first phase at Upton are now complete. The first residents of the both affordable, 30% of the houses are affordable, and market rate housing have moved in. One part of Phase D at Upton is being produced with the help of eco-architect Bill Dunster, which will promise an interesting dialogue between a deformed street grid and an approach towards solar orientation. He's got the roof lines doing this complicated north-south dance with the street grid. The Prince's Foundation and our colleague Paul Moraine are pushing the envelope even further at Sherford near Plymouth. We're working with a developer and a local authority to integrate traditional urbanism and building culture, modern construction methods, and new approaches to sustainability in an urban extension of Plymouth of 5,500 homes, with a new public transport-oriented high street, shopping district, and employment area, perhaps the first new high street in 75 years. Sherford is oriented around a system of green infrastructure, incorporating drainage as well as access to the community park, which the park itself will occupy about half of the land. Rather than little leftover bits of lawn, the parks of Sherford are linear or large, with the urbanism of the town compensated by the increased biodiversity and open space of the countryside. Suburbia tries to be country and town and ends up being neither. Sherford aims to have both. Sherford will include 40% or more affordable housing administered by a community trust. The buildings will achieve high energy efficiency standards and is committing to achieve, I think, is it 50% of its energy, Ben, from renewable energy sources. There's a commitment to local sourcing of material to build the place and a local food strategy. And we're gratified that incoming Prime Minister Gordon Brown just announced the creation of 5 eco-towns modeled on the Prince of Wales ecological villages, including Sherford. At the same time as we work at the scale of urbanism, it's important to work at the building scale, as Ed Mazria will remind us tomorrow. And so we've begun a collaboration with the Building Research Establishment to find ways to upgrade the performance of existing houses, particularly those from the Victorian and Edwardian area, which sit within sustainable urban neighborhoods. And we're exploring the design ideas behind the passive house to improve the building envelope and make houses that require little or no external heat and apply those to evolve traditional building typologies. These images from Ben Pentreat's new houses at Poundbury illustrate that green design need not be shiny or high tech. They employ rainwater harvesting, solar hot water, and photovoltaics on the rear elevation and meet the BREEAM EcoHome Excellence standards, proving, as Ben has done, that one can design a greenhouse in a green neighborhood without it resembling either Blade Runner or Amazing Stories science fiction books, takes us a long way toward consumer acceptance and market relevance. By and large, people want to live in traditional houses with contemporary features. And other things being equal, these old traditional houses remained on the market for a shorter time than the non-greenhouses it competes with at Poundbury, or than the suburban houses nearby. I believe that this is because they are seen by homebuyers as reflecting a real place that is powerful. Doug has led us on LEED ND, and we're grateful to Doug and Susan Mudge and Victor Dober for their contributions. We're hearing about the Architecture 2030 challenge from Ed Mazria, and Doug has begun to talk about a 2030 planning challenge. I think both need to be taken to a higher level. It's not buildings or planning, but it's a comprehensive, holistic approach to evolve our approach to the built environment to confront long-term sustainability. We need to take design leadership in addition to policy leadership and PR leadership. I am required to conclude with a quote from my president, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. Because he says it so much better than I ever do. I'm concerned that if we do not demonstrate that sustainability can be achieved in a manner that is natural, organic, and human-scaled, ecological design will come to be viewed as hard-edged, high-tech, and somehow related to steel and glass. And this will lessen its appeal to the vast majority of human beings across the globe, who instinctively know that cities built of natural, locally sourced materials designed with a harmony and proportion sustain our spirit, our sense of community, and the planet. Thank you very much.